Hi, I'm Ellie Carter from Extended, and if you've been enjoying our podcast, we really need your help. We need a few moments of your time to review Extended on Apple Podcasts or on your podcast player. A 5-star review would be brilliant, and it would be great if you could add some text as well. The more positive reviews, the better chance we have of raising the profile of the podcast and bringing even more great guest content in the future. It will only take a few moments of your time, and we would really appreciate your support. Thank you.
My view is that I want to try and cover the whole gamut of the Cold War experience as much as I can. And my main focus is around recording the oral histories or people's personal experiences of the Cold War. Because my view is that whilst you can read a really good account in a book, there's nothing like hearing it from somebody who was there. Because you get that, you know, when they're talking to you, you get the excitement in their voice or the sadness, the intonation, the breaths, the pauses.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Extended. It's time to talk aviation.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 136 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today I'm joined by Tim Robinson, and Tim is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you today?
Very well, thank you. Hello.
Good, good, good. Glad to have you back on. It's been a while since we've done one of these talkies, so looking forward to this one. And nothing really seems more popular in our aviation sector than Cold War aircraft. And today's guest is the presenter of one of the best historical military podcasts out there. That is, of course, Cold War Conversations. He's also a bit of an aviation fan and presents the Avro Museum podcast as well. Ian Sanders, welcome to Extended.
Well, thank you. I'm a little bit humbled by that intro, but Cold War Conversations is where my sort of podcasting started. But I'm delighted to also be a volunteer at the Avro Heritage Museum and produce and host their podcast there as well. So thank you for having me.
No, it's a delight. Been looking forward to this one for some time. And let's start with Cold War Conversations. It's been really well recognised. It's recognised with awards. Your feedback is really positive. Strong engagement. You've had some fascinating guests. Why do you think the Cold War subject is still so popular a topic?
I think for a lot of people, the Cold War was probably one of the most important events of their formative years. So of people of a certain age like me, the sort of 60s and 70s and 80s were, you know, a time where you felt that nuclear war could break out by accident or by design. And also that, you know, that there would be some sort of conflict between the Warsaw Pact countries and the NATO countries. And, you know, that period also produced iconic technology. You know, if you look at the, and we'll get on to Cold War aircraft in a little while, but you know, you've got some incredible Cold War aircraft, some of which didn't get off the into production as well, but you've got iconic military vehicles such as the Chieftain tank and the T-72, T-80, T-55 on the Warsaw Pact side, the Leopard in terms of German military vehicles. So you've got some iconic tech there as well. But I think that more and more media is portraying certainly the latter part of the Cold War, where you've got series like Deutschland 85, Deutschland 83. You've got even programs like Stranger Things. You've got movies like The Courier with Benedict Cumberbatch, which is showing the espionage side. Bridge of Spies with Tom Hanks that came out a few years back. There's a number of cultural aspects that are being portrayed in the media, which people are sort of thinking, oh, I'd like to know more about that. And they're almost like the gateway into learning more about the Cold War. And I think that that's why sort of my listenership continues to grow, because people want to learn more about that period. And there certainly is some resonance with the present day, particularly with this confrontation with Russia and over the Ukraine as well.
Yeah, and the one thing that really strikes me about Cold War conversations is you've mixed it up. We'll talk about some of the Cold War aircraft you've done and aviation features you've done, but you've covered, you know, espionage, military areas. But as I mentioned just before we started recording, one of the episodes that really sticks in my mind was just a guy who worked in Eastern Europe driving his Ford Escort around, you know, and it was a really, really fascinating listen that I suppose if I went back to when I was 18, I could quite easily have put myself in that place too. How have you managed to find that right blend of all those different topics?
I have no shortage of people who want to come on the podcast. I have an incredibly long list of potential guests there. But my view is that I want to try and cover the whole gamut of the Cold War experience as much as I can. And my main focus is around recording the oral histories or people's personal experiences of the Cold War, because my view is that whilst you can read a really good account in a book, there's nothing like hearing it from somebody who was there, because you get that, you know, when they're talking to you, you get the excitement in their voice or the sadness, the intonation, the breaths, the pauses, which bring the history so much more to life. And it's that human aspect of the history that I think audio is really good at capturing, because whilst video is great, I think sometimes you can be distracted by a video picture, yeah, and you don't really hear what somebody's saying or how they're saying it. And that for me is why I love podcasting, because you just get that intimacy, which is an overused word in podcasting, but I think a very valid word. You really get an intimacy, and you're actually in somebody's head for an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're a podcaster, although they don't hear me for an hour, thankfully, they, you know, the key for me is it's all about the guest. It's not about me. It's about the subject matter, and it's about the guest. But what I, as far as varying it, I try and make sure that I'm not doing too much military or I'm not doing too much aviation. So I try and mix, you know, a bit of civilian, a bit of military, which could be aviation, marine or land, or, you know, a bit of espionage or an author interview with a book that's coming out. So I try and mix it up so it's not the same old every week, because I think it's not about gaining listeners necessarily, although that has happened organically. It's more about preserving and recording what I would say are a lot of relatively unknown stories, and many of the stories that I capture have never been recorded before. So you mentioned that guy who was driving around East Germany in a Ford Escort working in various factories. He'd never spoken on audio about that story before.
Wow.
And I'm often in a situation where a relative will email me or something after I've recorded a story and say, a relative of the interviewee will email me and say, you know what, he or she has never gone into that level of detail before.
Yeah.
You know, I've never heard those stories. So it's a magical medium and one that appears to, you know, resonate with a significant number of people, for which I'm very grateful.
Do you think Cold War history has maybe been neglected in a sense? It's kind of so recent that it gets kind of discarded a little bit, and it's And also the fact, unlike the Second World War, it's not a hot war. You know, for the most, unless of course you were in Vietnam or Korea, but it's kind of almost sort of been, I wouldn't say forgotten, but sort of underappreciated, underanalyzed, and understudied.
I think you're correct there. It's funny. I was interviewed by a podcast a few months back, and it was they wanted me to come up with my pet gripe about the Cold War, and what I came up with is that people don't consider it a proper war, and proper war is probably the wrong phrase for it, but people don't take it seriously. Yeah. And I think you're right. I mean, I was very conscious with, you know, World War II, a lot of the veterans died before their stories were captured. And what I'm trying to do with Cold War Conversations is, well, the tagline for Cold War Conversations is recording the stories of the Cold War before they're lost.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, capturing these oral histories and making them available to everyone for free. And, you know, that's the aim, is really to bring these stories to a wider audience. And, you know, the guests that I have on, that's one of the major reasons they want to be on, is they want to make sure that their life that they experienced is preserved for the future so that people can, you know, hear those stories. So,
yeah, it's just fascinating to pick up those various threads. And in some ways, in my mind, having listened to you for a couple of years now, string the whole picture together. It's really interesting because they're on the main grassroots stories, but you can actually thread them together because we just get the high level stuff, you know, the big political stuff, a bit of the spying, a bit of the sexy stuff that way. But, you know, real life for people in what was East Germany, you know, when you hear about it, it's really visceral, you know, and we thought we had it hard when we were growing up, you know, but it's just learning all those lessons. It's a real fascinating listen. But let's jump on to aviation. Let's talk about some of the aviation features that you had. You got a nice tag on the website that allows you to sort your podcasts by type. And for anyone who wants to quickly go and see the aviation episodes, we'll put some links into the show notes, but you can see it directly on Cold War Conversations website. There's a couple that stick out. Some really unique stuff that even we wouldn't have ever have got to, like the Yak 28 that crashed in the British sector of West Berlin. I'd never heard that story before.
Yeah, that's quite a popular episode, that one, which I'm pleased to say. That one came across. I'd been in contact with Bernd von Koska of the Allied Museum in Berlin. And he told me a couple of stories, and he was producing a book which was combining together a number of stories about Cold War Berlin. And this crash into the Stossensee in Berlin, this Yak 28 crash, was one of the chapters that he featured in the book. And again, it's a relatively unknown story,
yeah.
A fascinating tale of NATO trying to keep the Russians away from salvaging this plane. Well, the plane falls in the British sector, so it's underwater, and the Russians say, look, we want it back. And the British say, oh, well, you know, we're trying to raise it for you. Meanwhile, the British have divers under there taking big chunks of it off and hauling it off to Farnborough so that they can have a good look at it. And so they managed to put the Russians off, I think, for a week or so. And then they bring it all back from Farnborough, hastily sort of just hand it over to the Russians as though they've just, you know, pulled it out of this lake. And I think the Russians are under no illusion, really, what the British are up to. And I think one bit is actually completely missing. The Russians don't get all of the aircraft back as well. But it's a really interesting story, and one that I'd not heard in detail before, because there's a danger of quite a sort of almost an armed confrontation with the Russians when they arrive at the lake to say, look, we want our aircraft back. great story, that one. Really, really enjoyed it, and a fun episode.
Yeah. Tim, did you know about that one, by the way? I'm sure you did.
I didn't know. I mean, obviously, I'd heard of odd things where, was there a MiG-23 that went on, was pilot ejected and it started heading for the border, and various things where stuff starts, heading for the border. And I think there was maybe a Harrier as well that was shot down before.
There was a MiG-23 where the pilot had some sort of problem over Poland.
Yeah,
and he ejected, and the plane didn't go down. It just went off flying horizontally and it crossed into NATO airspace. We didn't shoot it down, and it eventually crashed in Belgium. I think it hit a house and killed somebody.
Wow.
In Belgium.
Wow. Oh, there's one to add to the list, Ian.
Well, as I say, it's a big list.
Yeah.
But no, it's a good story. That one. And the other thing that I found that I wasn't necessarily aware of is some of the shoot downs over East Germany. There was a US Air Force plane that crossed the border, I think in the 1950s or 60s. And the Russians intercepted it, couldn't radio the aircraft, and eventually shot it down, killing the crew.
Wow.
I can't remember what type of plane it was. And there's various theories that maybe the oxygen supply failed on the plane. So the crew were unconscious and basically it just flew on autopilot. And the Soviets decided to shoot it down.
There was a Lincoln shot down as well, wasn't there? Abro Lincoln.
Yeah.
By MiG-15s.
Yeah, well, the whole story of the Berlin Air Corridor I find fascinating as well, because, you know, you've got, particularly during the Berlin airlift, and in fact, one of the guys I interviewed was the candy bomber of Berlin airlift fame, Gail Halvorsen,
wow,
who's, I think, now 101. I think he was 98 when I interviewed him, and he describes coming out of some cloud and seeing a yak directly in front of him, and him having to take real quick evasive action avoid it. So there's more stories for me to cover on there, I think. But there's a good range of stuff on there. I mean, you've mentioned the Stossensee one, which isn't actually an eyewitness account, it's a historian talking about that.
Yeah.
But I've got various favourites on there. I think one of the ones that appears to be particularly popular is the one with the F-111 pilot from Lakenheath.
Yeah. F-111s are pretty popular, actually. Swing wing. You had Ian Black as well.
Yeah,
Lightning.
That was a good one.
And I got to say, I did enjoy your Vulcan features as well. And that sort of brings me to the work you do with the Avro Museum. You're a volunteer there.
Yes, that's right.
How did that happen? Why did that happen?
Well, they're virtually my local Cold War museum, really, because I'm Manchester-based, despite the accent. And they were my local Cold War museum. They've got a Vulcan there, so how can you not want to volunteer at a museum that has a Vulcan? I noticed that they didn't have a podcast, so I said, look, I can help you with this, because this is a great way of publicizing the work that you do, and just helping to get visitors to the museum. And I said, the other thing here is the museum should be working on building an oral history archive as well.
Yeah.
Because there's a number of people who work there who flew, either flew these aircraft, serviced them, built them, you know, what have you, who have a story to tell that people would want to listen to. So I started the Avro Heritage Museum podcast last year, but I've changed job in November, so that has sort of limited what I can do. But we've had four episodes, including a VC-10 pilot a Vulcan pilot who ended up flying the Fairey Gannet as well.
Yes, that was a good one.
Off aircraft carriers, and that was entertaining.
That sort of threw me a bit. I was listening and I thought, how the hell did he end up doing that? And again, it's just one of those stories, isn't it? You follow someone's life journey, and that's where it took him. And I just thought, that's just fascinating. You couldn't write it, really, as they say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing, you know, sometimes I've been lucky with guests, and I think I'm reasonably good at trying to get the most out of a guest and having a fun conversation with them. So I do try and have a little bit of humor in there where we can. Obviously, a lot of the time we're talking about quite serious subjects, but generally most guests have some sort of anecdote where it's amusing in some kind of way. And that does sort of give you a bit of light and dark in an episode, which I think helps make it entertaining.
And one question I have had in my mind, I should have put it on one of your feedbacks, actually, Ian, but seeing as I've got you, I'll ask you now. What's the window that you cover? Because I was thinking about some of the stuff we've done on the Falklands, and we talk about some of the aircraft that were involved in that, and we sort of think of them as Cold War aircraft. But then it made me think, what's that window that Cold War Conversations covers?
I take Cold War Conversations in its broadest possible sense. So I also look at the cultural aspect of the Cold War, the political aspect, the military aspect, you know, as many aspects as I can. And I have been looking at doing a Falklands War episode because whilst it's not a confrontation between the Warsaw Pact and NATO, there's an element of Soviet involvement there because I think they were providing some data to the Argentines. There's certainly Cold War technology being used. I mean, you know, there's destroyers that the Argentines have got, which we sold them earlier in the Cold War period. And I think where was the aircraft carrier from? That wasn't one of ours, was it originally? I can't remember. But it's all part of that tapestry of the Cold War experience, because my view is it's the experiences between 1946, 7, 8 through to 1991 is sort of the period I'm looking at.
Right.
So the Falklands, I think, definitely fits into that. And it's part of the British Army experience. I mean, you can argue that the British Army's experience in the Falklands potentially helped evolve their tactics in some of the Cold War fronts that they were involved in.
Yeah. We've just spoken to recently to John Shields, who is our final feature on the Falklands in a set of six that we've done. And he takes a strategic look. And one of the interesting discussions we had is, of course, most of the forces, ground, air, sea, trained for a Cold War and not a conventional war on the other side of the world in all sorts of weathers, particularly from ship-based bases. And it was a really interesting conversation because we trained for the Cold War, basically, and all of a sudden you ask these military teams to change the way they thought and fight a different way. And it brought a different angle to that. Oh, yeah, we set up to fight everything across mainland Europe, and here we go. Here we are fighting it from sea on the other side of the world.
Well, I mean, that was the same thing when we had John Nicol on. Obviously, you know, talking about the Gulf War, because they'd obviously trained to kind of go and attack Soviet airfields in East Germany, and you know, hug the terrain and kind of come in over hills and stuff, and suddenly they're finding themselves attacking an Iraqi airfields with completely flat desert all around.
It's just fascinating. Well, let's move on then. One of the things we sort of agreed before we came on air is that we'd have a little bit of a discussion about our favourite Cold War aircraft. So let's have a little round robin. We got three choices each. Ian, we'll start with you. We'll do one at a time and we'll go around. What's your favourite Cold War aircraft?
Okay, well, I did put together a top three, actually.
Okay, well, fire them all at us then.
Okay,
go on.
So in number three, I had the Harrier. Now, the Harrier for me, okay, it's an iconic plane in the Falklands, because you can argue it did allow us to retain air superiority over the Falklands. But it was a very iconic plane during the Cold War in Europe, because you get these images of these forest-bound airstrips and the Harrier rising out of the depths of a forest to go off on a mission, and an absolutely unique aircraft. I mean, the Soviets tried to imitate it, didn't they, with one of their Yak aircraft, which, from what I understand, was vastly inferior to what the Harrier could do. But that for me is one of the real iconic Cold War aircraft, and quite a unique aircraft as well. For number two, and this might surprise people, is another Hawker Siddeley aircraft, but it's the Chipmunk. Now,
okay, that one's thrown me, but I know why.
okay. Well, you know, with the Chipmunk, most people think of it as the the stalwart training aircraft of the RAF from, you know, the 1950s through to the 80s, and it replaced the Tiger Moth. But for me, its importance was in Berlin, because in Berlin, the British garrison there had a couple of Chipmunks at RAF Gattau, which was in the British sector of Berlin. And under the agreement over Berlin at the end of World War II, they created, the Soviets, the British and the Americans and the French created the Berlin Air Control Sector, which was a 20-mile radius, 20-kilometer, actually, it's probably radius, I can't remember, it might be 20 miles radius from the center of Berlin. And it was an area where all of the former World War II allies could fly, controlled by a control center that was in the center of Berlin and organized by all four occupying powers. But what it did allow, this zone also allowed views into various military establishments around Berlin, including some quite significant training areas and significant Soviet military bases. So what the British did is they used their Chipmunk to ostensibly sort of show their rite of passage around this control zone, but overflew these Soviet military bases. And there's some great photos of, there's one photo of a guy aiming an AK-47 as they flew low over some Soviet base. And there is a tale, and I've yet to get to the bottom of this, that apparently they did come back with a couple of bullet holes in the Chipmunk at some point, but I'm not sure whether that's just somebody spinning a yarn there. But that's why I've included the Chipmunk, because it was it wasn't just a trainer, it was an operational reconnaissance plane in the Berlin area, and gave us some quite valuable information about what the Soviets were up to around Berlin.
I'd forgotten that one, actually, Ian. Tim, you're gonna have to add that one to your list as well. You do need to listen to that one, it's really good, it's really fascinating. And then finally,
well, you know, I'm a volunteer at the Avro Heritage Centre. It's got to be the Avro Shackleton. No, actually, it's the Avro Vulcan. It's the Avro Vulcan, yeah. You know, probably the most famous British aircraft of the Cold War, possibly, yeah. And certainly the most unmistakable. When I moved up to Manchester about 25 years ago, they were still doing the Woodford Air Show, which is where the Avro Heritage Centre is based. And I'll never forget, you know, seeing that plane. And I remember being in a pub garden one summer and, you know, you're sitting there drinking, but suddenly the sky goes dark and there's this enormous roar as this big V-wing came over. And it had taken off, you know, it was a Vulcan that had taken off from Woodford. And it's just unmistakable.
Totally get that one. In fact, yesterday I was looking through some old photos and the photos of 558 that I took not that long ago of her flight, doing some displays. And it's so easily gone now, you know, that's gone forever. And we're very fortunate to have had her back in the skies. But it's a bit like the stories you tell. You know, you have to grab them while they're there and appreciate them while they're there. So, yep, that's a good list. Interesting list, that. Interesting.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Tim, how about you then?
Ooh, crikey, well, I'm on the spot here, aren't I?
You are.
Pull three. Okay, so first one I think will have to be the Vulcan's counterpart, the B-52. It's still in service now. Swept wing, they got it right when they were, you know, well, coming from the B-47, you know, ironically enough, German swept wing design, and they were going to go for a. I think the original thing was they were going to go for a straight wing for the B-47, led into the B-52, and it's still going strong today. And it, you know, if you have a book or you know a cold war, somebody knows nothing about the Cold War, and you say, draw me a bomber from it, they're going to draw a B-52 or some approximation of a B-52. Obviously, Dr. Strangelove, Dawn's Early Light, those kind of stuff. That's what you think of. Next one would be MiG-21, most produced supersonic jet fighter in history.
Yeah.
Still in service today in batches around there. It's still potent. You can put sensors on it. You can put a helmet-mounted sight on it. It goes like stink. Very dangerous, to fly, but it planes and it's still in service. And you can't really sort of say that. I mean, you know, much as I like the Lightning, that was just one country and so a couple of countries, ourselves and the Saudis and Kuwait, but MiG-21 exported all around the world. So on that subject as well, I suppose I have to go for the Phantom F4. Otherwise, Gareth will kill me. But again, that is, you know, your quintessential Cold War, you know, ugly, you know, kind of double ugly. You know, kind of multi-role fighter. You know, the first multi-role, all-weather, you know, two-seat fighter, you know. And the amount of countries that used it, still use it, still going strong, you know. And that was a step up, really, from, what came before. Was present all through the Cold War and you know, beyond.
Right, well, you've stolen one of mine now. I'm going to have to... I'm going to have a little think. Because, the Phantom for me when I was growing up as a kid was just the aeroplane. I mean, it's not attractive. Well, I don't think it's that attractive, but it is to me. It just epitomised everything in that sort of Cold War era. So, okay, I'll have to park that. But seeing as we've got the B-52 and we've got the Vulcan, I'm going to go for the TU-95 Bear.
Ooh.
Have to match the triangle, have to close the triangle and put the Bear in there. I mean, still flying after all these years, pounding away. The stories we've heard from F4 pilots, from Lightning pilots, from Typhoon pilots, you know, it's still there. It's plugging away. I've always had a bit of a fascination for Russian and Soviet aircraft. We've produced a few interesting episodes on them. So I'm going to go with the Bear to match the Vulcan and the B-52. I have to go for the Tomcat. I have to go for the F-14. It just felt so boring, you know, isn't everyone going to do? I just loved it. I just love it as an aircraft. I remember seeing it perform when I was a teenager. Just raw power, loud, big monster. A bit like the F-111, you know, nice swing wing, something a bit different. So I've gone for that. Now, I would have gone for the Phantom as my third, but that's gone. So I'm really struggling. And Ian, you've sort of sown a seed by something you said earlier when you mentioned the VC-10. I love the VC-10. Again, you know, British aerospace at its best at the time, but British aerospace marketing at its worst. And it's a shame to not seen that succeed as much as it could have, but went on to serve with the RAF. And that almost turned my mind, but I've got to go for the Lightning. I've got to go for the Lightning. In her latter years, my mum moved up to Lincolnshire. She lived near Louth. So we had Binbrook just up the road. And we'd go and stay with mum for the weekend and just turn our heads to the sky and see those monsters leaping straight up. Just fantastic sound. Very unusual shape. Got a model on my shelf behind me, so I'll go for the Lightning. So mine three are the Lightning, the Tomcat, and the Bear.
Really good choices there. I think what's interesting is there's a number of designs we were talking about there that are still in service, even 30 years after the end of the Cold War, which I just find incredible.
Yeah.
You know, I can understand a civil aircraft still being in service, but for a military aircraft to still be thought of as a viable platform, I just find incredible with the pace of technology.
And what they're saying about the B-52, Tim, it could go on for another 20, 30 years?
Probably be the first 100-year aircraft.
Wow.
The South African Air Force has got a C-47 that's been upgraded that was they used for maritime patrol that was actually built in 1944.
Wow.
So I and Hueys, Hueys and Chinooks as well. Honourable mention for helicopters.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what then, why don't we each choose a Cold War helicopter? If I'm not putting everyone on the spot, I'll tell you what, I'll go first this time. I'll go for the Sea King. I love the Sea King. Saw it in Royal Navy service, and I was so lucky to get a flight on one when it retired. So I'll go for the good old Sea King in Royal Navy service. Tim, how about you? We'll give Ian a bit of time.
It's got to be the Mi-24 Hind, doesn't it?
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, like you Afghanistan, you know, Central Front. Whenever you look to any kind of US DOD or US Army manual of you know, how things had, or any kind of alternative Cold War fiction of how things you know would kind of go horribly wrong, you know, as well as mushroom clouds and people with gas masks and NBC suits. You know, you'd always see you know, hordes of hinds heading your way, you know. So I think, you know, that was it's still in service today. You know, it's a bloody terrifying attack helicopter that's still in service.
Good shout.
Yeah, I was going to go for the hind, and in fact, it reminded me of one of my episodes where a bricksmith guy describes being toe to toe with a hind helicopter. So he was following it, and it just sits right in front of him, and the people in the helicopter in the hind are sort of gesticulating at him. There's a Soviet officer in the back, you know, doing hand signals at him, and you can imagine the hand signals that the bricksmith guys gave back. But it's an interesting view into you know, what bricksmith got up to in East Germany. But I think we mentioned it at the top of this was the Chinook, unmistakable sound. It's a Chinook before it's, you know, you can see it, and you know, again, a design that's held its own for quite some time. I'm not sure when the Chinook was first.
Didn't they have them the back end of Vietnam?
Yeah.
Tim?
Yeah. So it's 70s.
Yeah.
So, you know, incredible design that's, you know, kept going through the years, obviously through various enhancements. But I think the Chinook for me, as the hind had gone.
I'll tell you more. I got two Chinook stories, actually. Been in a Chinook, and it is loud. Mm-hmm. It is loud. You have to wear a bone dome, otherwise your brains literally will drop out your ears. They melt and drop out. That's what I remember. But my Chinook story is, we live down in Dorset, and we occasionally get them coming over. And I was driving home from work, and I could see this Chinook about 4 or 5 miles away, flying over what I thought was my house, you know, sort of area. I was thinking, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if my wife can see it. She was sunbathing in a bikini. And I got home and I said, oh, did you see that? She said, yeah, they were flying just over the house. They were spinning around and I'm sure they were waving. I said, well, of course they were. They were looking at you sunbathing. She said, no, they were being really nice. I said, no, I think they were looking at you sunbathing. And I did drop them a line on social media and they responded. You know, it's great. And that's one of the great things about where we're at with some of the stuff we do. You do get those responses. So that's my Chinook story. And then just finally to wrap up this little chat, we were going to try and think of our favourite Cold War movie. We were trying to link it to aviation, but we were struggling a bit. So, Tim, I'm going to come to you first.
Oh, is this the last question? I've got another one. Oh,
No. Just for this section, you can have another question. Just for this section, favourite Cold War movie. Let's say it doesn't have to be an aviation one. Can be, but it doesn't have to be.
So, Doctor Strangelove.
Oh, okay.
So, it's not wholly aviation, but there are, there's an airborne nuclear strike taking place in it, and there's, Peter Sellers is the RAF commander, isn't he? You know, the liaison, and as among other characters in it, and it just one of the things that you know why. You know, it sort of enjoy was looking forward to this really episode so much, Ian, is you know, we can't quite, it just seems so surreal that you know, I remember being back at, you know, kind of secondary school, and we just thought, you know, age 12, 14, you know, we thought, well, we're gonna have to grab our air rifles and go up and kind of into the woods and stuff, and maybe we can hold the Russians off because there's going to be a war. You know, it was not a case of, you know, there might be a war. There's definitely going to be a war. it's something is going to spark it off, and there's going to be nukes flying, and you know, you're just waiting for World War III to break out, you know, and it seems so surreal. And, you know, I don't think people quite realize now the huge sigh of relief in 1989, 1990, when, you know, you could wake up and go, oh, hang on, you know, the missiles aren't going to start flying tomorrow morning, you know.
Yeah.
We've lived through it and survived.
Yeah. I think also when people look back at the Cold War, there was almost more certainty. You knew who your who the enemy was in theory. You know, there wasn't such asymmetric warfare and all of these sort of things. And okay, you had terrorism because you had, you know, the Northern Ireland and the IRA, but it just seemed a more straightforward time, I think, for some people. But you're absolutely right. I mean, that it's difficult for people who didn't live through it to have understood that fear that we had at the time, that either we were going to be blown apart by nuclear weapons or there was going to be Spetsnaz appearing on the high street.
So, Ian, what's your favourite Cold War movie?
Okay, well, I'm going to give two answers here, because my favourite Cold War movie is Hunt for Red October, despite Sean Connery's atrocious Russian in it. But I just think it's a brilliantly constructed film, and I love submarine movies anyway, and this one I think really hits all the points. But I did think, look, I need to come up with an aviation themed Cold War movie, and Tim briefly mentioned it earlier, but By Dawn's Early Light, which Ooh. Was made at the cusp of the end of the Cold War, and it's available in its entirety on YouTube if people want to watch it. But its basic premise is there's a dissident Soviets who launch a missile to try and provoke a war, and they launch a missile at Donetsk, so to try and make it look as though NATO has started a war, and the main part of the film features a B-52 crew who have been scrambled to launch the counterstrike, and the B-52 is crewed by Powers Booth, who people will be familiar from the 1980s, and Rebecca De Mornay is his co-pilot in that. But it's well worth a look, and it still stands up well, I think, nowadays if you watch it.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Well, I could have, seen as I went for the Tomcat, I could have gone the easy route. But I'm just thinking about something a bit different. And I'm not saying it was a great film. The book was better than the film, but I'm going to go for Firefox.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It made me think when we suggested this might be a good idea. What could I come up with? I remember the book. I remember then seeing the film, which I was a bit disappointed about. But I suppose when you read a book, you have a very vivid image in your mind of what it would be. But I thought it was not bad at all. Who doesn't like Clint? That's my... going to go down for my favourite.
Yeah, I was thinking, actually, I could have gone for Apocalypse Now, because old Robert Duvall and his Ride of the Valkyries scene is a strong one, to say the least.
Good shout, actually. Good
I love
shout.
The smell of napalm in the morning. Great lines.
Yeah, that is. So as we head towards the end, Tim, you've got one question loaded or two.
Right. So my final question, actually. So it's sort of looking at the strategic level of kind of air power in the Cold War. And my question would be, and obviously this is supremely topical at the moment, given the current situation, you know, as we record, but could NATO air forces, could NATO have held Warsaw Pact up, and could have they held the line? Because, you know, you look back now and you go, wow, didn't RAF Germany have loads and loads of airplanes? Didn't we have, you know, we had loads of squadrons, we had loads of this stuff. And yet, you know, you talk to some of the veterans now and they'll say, you know, we were expected to last 3 days. Or the supply, and actually it's the supply and the logistics is we didn't have enough bombs and missiles. You know, we'd have, even if we survived, even by some miracle we survived, we'd be out of Sparrows, we'd be out of Sidewinders within 3 days, and that would be it. You know, then what? What's your take on that?
My take is I'd agree with that. I recently did an interview with a British Army artillery major, and he was of the same opinion. He said, look, everything was in the shop window, and the resupply would not have been there. And he made the analogy of the first Gulf War, where they had to rob all the power packs out of the Chieftain tank divisions in and Challenger tanks in Europe in order to equip just one division in the Gulf, so that they had enough there to actually keep the tracks running, which I know is not aviation, but I would imagine it would be a similar problem. But, you know, I interviewed this F-111 pilot, Rick Shreve, who'd actually been part of the El Dorado Canyon raid on Libya as well. But his view was interesting because I said to him, well, what did he think would happen when if the balloon went up? And his view was that they would continue fighting, do as much damage as they could until the reinforcements arrived from the US. So like the 7th Cavalry come over the hill. And I said to him, did you really believe that? And he answered very quickly, yes, which I was surprised at. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's just it's a different viewpoint, and that's what I find with Cold War conversations is there's lots of different viewpoints around similar experiences, and yeah. Obviously this is just one pilot I was talking to here who believed that the reinforcements would arrive and they would beat the Soviets, but others, you know, inevitably will have contradictory views. But I think you're right. I think the logistics is the key, as with any battle. And I think that, you know, the supply would have, you know, faded away after about 3 days of constant combat. And also the attrition of the air crews. I mean, the mental attrition there of flying constant sorties. I just don't think it would have been sustainable. But you know, I'm not of the military. I'm not a pilot, so I'm talking from a particular angle of not knowing, but just trying to put myself in those shoes. I don't think, you know, unless there was a political solution, and that's the other thing that I hear from some of the interviewees. I interviewed the last British commandant of the Berlin sector. And I said, what was your plans for Berlin if the Warsaw Pact had tried to take West Berlin? He said, well, the intention was to try and hold them off for at least 3 days until there was a political solution. Mm. And I think that was the belief, is if we could just sort of get to some sort of stalemate, then there might have been a political agreement of some kind. But yeah. Anyway, that's my tuppence worth.
Yeah. I mean, the converse to that is that we'd built, you know, in a sense, we'd also built the kind of Warsaw Pact up to be this giant kind of military machine that functioned perfectly and had a perfect plan, and all these amazing aircraft that they had. You know, and well, you know, they've got MiG-25s, they've got Firefoxes, they've got MiG-29s. You know, and they're as advanced as ours, and they've got lots of them. And then obviously, you know, the Iron Curtain came down and we found out, oh, actually, they're not really that good at all. You know, they're not as, you know, I had read recently somebody thought they said, you know, it was they were only 30% of what we, 30% of the capability we expected.
Yeah, and I think the BRICSmith guys were under no illusion about that. They were feeding intelligence back because they were monitoring these exercises, and that, you know, they could see that the, and I think people think of the Soviet army as being this massive monolith, but it was made up of many nations and many languages. So they had an immense language problem because not all of their troops spoke Russian. Because of the vastness of the Soviet Empire, and I think you're right. The BRICSmith guys I've spoken to sort of, you know, feel that there was no appetite for the Russians to actually fight because they knew that it was not going to be an easy, you know, an easy win, and they were aware of their own shortcomings as well.
And a lot of, Ian, a lot of the interviews you've done have been very local to that part of Europe. Mm. You've had some Americans and some North American, you know, Canadian, North American focus as well. How do you feel they genuinely felt towards the potential for, whether it be an air, ground, or combined battle would be? Because it's sort of feels more distant for them.
Well, for those that are serving in Europe, I think they'd have the same view of, you know, the Royal Air Force, in so much that, you know, that they would try and hold out as long as possible. But I think with the Canadians, what's interesting, and you don't often really necessarily recognize with this with the geography, but the Soviet Union is not that far away from Canada over the North Pole. And you know, their air force was the, you know, the first line of defense for any you know, strategic bomber force coming over in that direction. So they were almost the equivalent, well, they were doing similar sorties to what the Royal Air Force did and still do in terms of monitoring the bears coming over the North Sea. So it's not that distant. It appears distant because we look at it from a Eurocentric across the Atlantic way. But,
true.
You know, that distance over the North Pole is not that far. And that's why all the airlines fly that way as well.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. I think we're just about coming to the end then. One thing we do want to find out, Ian, is where we can find Cold War Conversations online.
Right. Our website is coldwarconversations.com, and that has links to the major podcast apps if you want to find a link there. We're on Twitter @ColdWarPod. Facebook, Cold War Conversations, Instagram, Cold War Conversations, and we have a Facebook discussion group as well, which is quite vibrant in there. We have a lot of veterans in there.
Yeah, I fell into it in the last week or so, and it's quite easy to get swallowed up in there. So if you like Cold War Conversations, it's a great place to go.
Yeah, yeah, no. The way I frame it on the podcast is, I say, you know, the Cold War conversation continues on the in the discussion group, and there's some great discussions and some great pieces that people post on there. But just search Cold War Conversations, and you'll find us. You'll find the website, and you'll find the links to the podcast, and you will be very welcome. Listeners there. If you particularly want to look for the aviation stuff, then there's a tag cloud on our website, and just click on the aviation section, and that'll take you through to all of those. We also have some what I would say really good space episodes. So we have an episode on Gagarin, we have an episode on on the first moon landing. The writer I interviewed for the Gagarin episode, Stephen
Walker.
He's
unbelievable.
He was one of those guests where I thought, I just need to hit the record button and let him go.
Yeah.
I did. I mean, I hardly interrupted him, but
I'll tell you, Ian, he was on our radar as soon as the book came out. When I heard your episode, I thought, no point. No point talking to the guy. Because it was he was brilliant. And you had him back as well to talk. Was it recently? Relatively recently,
yeah,
didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, well, I had him back to talk about... Well, we talked about Titov, who was the other
cosmonaut. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And we also... talked about God, surprising.
It's the power of podcasting. As soon as I heard his interview with you, I literally went out and bought that book.
Yeah. Well, I get various people who sort of say, God, my wallet's not going to be able to have any more Cold War conversations episodes. Oh, I know what the episode was. It was the Apollo Soyuz mission with the link up with the Soviets.
Yeah.
So he sort of virtually become my de facto space correspondent for Cold War conversations.
He is brilliant. I got to say, they're great episodes. We'll put some links as well to those. I'll dig out the direct links for those.
Well, we've got an episode planned with him about the Soviet moon program.
Excellent. Look forward
coming up
to that
as well.
Yeah, well, there you go. If we haven't heard enough to tempt you to go over to Cold War Conversations, I don't know what you need. Ian, it's been fabulous. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really, really enjoyed that.
Fantastic.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I'm always keen to support fellow podcasters, whether they're Cold War or otherwise, because I think, you know, the independent podcaster needs to be supported, and there's some great indie podcasts out there, and yours is absolutely one of them.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate that. So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon, as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including the Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find the whole team on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I am online. I'm on tweeting at RES Tim R, and the Royal Aeronautical Society can be found at www.aerosociety.com.
And Tim, just before we sign off, I know you were due to be in Singapore as we record. What's going on in the Aero Society at the moment? Still lots of webinars going on. There's still some good content coming through that way.
Yeah, so obviously, like the rest of the world, we've been locked down for the past 2 years. So things are gradually are slowly returning to normal in terms of our events and lectures and things like that. You know, sort of more hybrid events where you can have a turn up physically or log in via Skype or Teams or what have you. But what it has meant is that we've built up an absolutely fantastic collection of lectures and webinars that are on the Aero Society YouTube channel, which, I mean, it's an absolute gold mine of stuff of all about aeronautics, aviation history, space flight, you name it. So I've still got to catch up with all the stuff that's on there, because, you know, usually we have 400 events a year and you can't get to all of them. And, you know, they take place and you kind of miss them. And now, you know, thanks to the, you know, obviously thanks to the terrible pandemic, they've been saved and for posterity, and we've now got them on the YouTube channel. So head on over to the Society's YouTube channel and have a look.
Right, thanks very much, Tim. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Bye all.
And it's goodbye from Ian Sanders.
Goodbye. Thank you.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
The cockpit's very cramped. You've got leg restraints on. You're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.